This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Welcome to the Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. In this episode, I've called in the experts to help us answer this question. Is liberalism on the wane? As 2016 came to a close, listeners to the BBC's most important news programme heard this from the Israeli historian Yuval Noah Harari.
In the future, 2016 may be remembered as the year in which Westerners have lost faith in the liberal story.
The rot had started, he argued, with the crash of 2008 and was now setting in.
Whereas a few years ago, Americans and Europeans were still trying to liberalize Iraq and Libya at the point of the gun, they now have second thoughts even about American democracy and European identity. The year 2016, marked by the Brexit vote in Britain and the rise of Donald Trump in the United States, signified the moment when this tidal wave of disillusionment has reached the core liberal states of Western Europe and North America.
But what actually is liberalism? And can such a historically successful idea become obsolete? This week, we'll be looking at this question as though briefing an intelligent visitor from outer space. Not for liberalism or against it, but interested in what's happening to it. Joining me in the briefing room this week is a journalist and author who grew up on a working-class council estate. Lindsay Hanley is now a visiting fellow at Liverpool John Moores University. She's on the line from Merseyside. Also with me is Sir Oliver Letwin, the Conservative strategist. And on the line from Boulder, Colorado, is journalist Edmund Fawcett, whose book Liberalism, The Life of an Idea, charts the rise and rise of liberalism from Victorian social reformers to Margaret Thatcher's economics. Edmund, I'm going to start with you. What is liberalism?
Well, I think at risk of sounding a bit abstract, as a set of ideals in politics, liberalism is quite simple. It's all about improving people's lives, treating them and their enterprises with equal respect, and ensuring protections against undue power, whether it's the power of the state, of wealth, or popular majorities. Liberals also have a picture of society. They take moral and material conflict as inevitable. There is never going to be harmony, there never was. The thing for liberals is to contain conflict and make it fruitful if they can. For example, in argument, experiment, exchange.
By contradistinction, which philosophies see society as not being in conflict?
This is incredibly schematic, but I think, as your introduction showed, it's terribly important to understand what it is we're talking about. And partly liberalism comes into definition by seeing its classic opponents, socialism and conservatism. Socialists, unlike liberals, trust the power of the people. Progress for them tends to mean radical transformation. They think that liberal respect for people's choices and personal aims undermines comradeship, solidarity. They think that social conflict will somehow end once its sources in material inequity have been removed. Conservatives think authority is to be respected, not challenged or asked for reasons. They're very skeptical about the scope for progress in a broad sense. They think liberals overindulge human willfulness, overplay choice while neglecting duty. And finally, conservatives treat society in a way as harmonious, or at least it was harmonious, until critical modernity and class envy destroyed it. So I think there, in very, very schematic terms, you have a sort of picture of three broad philosophies of politics.
Edmund, thank you very much for that. And I'm just going to bring Lindsay and Oliver in here and ask you what either of you would add or subtract to that definition. Oliver.
I think it's pretty good, actually. The only thing I think I want to add is that, Amy, you said it was schematic, and it is, but the disadvantage of schema is that inevitably they leave out the complexity of actual life. And one of those complexities is that there are people who are liberal conservatives or liberal socialists or less and liberal, indeed illiberal conservatives or illiberal socialists and so on. And that's because I think at root, socialism and conservatism have completely different views of the state. And the liberal view of the state is a different one, again, from either of them. Liberals are concerned about making sure that the power of the state is not overweening against the individual. And you can therefore be, I mean, take Diane Abbott, for example, in Britain. She is, I think, on the liberal wing of the left of the Labour Party. But you could also have somebody on the authoritarian wing of the left of the Labour Party. And so these things get muddled up a bit.
Well, thank you for messing up our schema there, etc. Lindsay, would you like to unmess it for me?
I would add to that that liberalism, as it's sort of presented as a set of values, has its own sort of constructs that are related to class and are related to our positions in society. And of course, individuals react against that and make their own decisions based on their experiences. But I would still see liberalism as something that isn't completely objective and needs to be looked at through our social standing, really.
OK, let's look a little bit at the history, Edmund. When can we say that liberalism began its dominance?
Well, I think it began in, like conservatism, they grew up like kind of left and right feet in the 19th century in response to a historically completely novel condition of society, which was being overturned in every way by population growth, urbanization, and the onset of industrial capitalism. I mean, this is the modern world in which we live. But I mean, not to give an enormous history lesson, I think today's politics dates from the middle of the 20th century. I mean, to come close to ground, as an actual practice of politics, liberalism is completely familiar to all of us in its democratic variant in North America, across Western Europe, and now much of Europe, as liberal democracy. We're completely familiar with it.
Edmund Fawcett, we hear this word neoliberalism. What's the difference between neoliberalism and liberalism?
Neoliberalism, I think, is a quite narrowly economic doctrine. Neoliberalism tries to persuade us that markets in the national economy solve everything, and states should do very, very little, if anything, to interfere with them. I stress that it isn't all of liberalism, and indeed neoliberalism has a very poor politics and a very poor, almost no geopolitics. It has really no broad theory of how to organise and manage world trade, world flows of finance.
So what is the difference between economic liberalism, as we've understood it before, and neoliberalism?
Really, I think they're labels for the same thing. Neoliberalism simply is a rather rude label that came into play in the last 20, 30 years. But there have been economic liberals from the beginning, from the early 19th century.
One of the contradictions, the obvious contradictions for the liberals as you describe them, is how they deal with the non-liberals.
I think it is important to take seriously the idea that liberals accept conflict. That doesn't mean that liberals are neutral in every dispute. If you look at, I don't know, scientists, for example, apparently most of them don't believe in God. If you look at liberals, I suspect you'll find a great deal of secularism and a lack of what's called sort of, you know, social conservatism. It doesn't at all mean that liberals therefore think, because they don't believe in God or they don't believe in social conservatism, that people who do believe in God or social conservatism should be treated differently. I think
they just think they're wrong.
They think they're wrong, but they think it all needs to be argued for, and that everybody has a right to say what they want, and that large powers shouldn't favour one group rather than another.
Oliver Letwin.
I personally wouldn't use the word conflict. I would use the word argument or debate. The point is that a liberal believes that you don't get at the truth by having somebody standing on a mountain telling you what it is. You get at it by debate and argument and constant dialectic.
But also, presumably, Oliver Letwin, you don't get at it through simply quoting authority.
Precisely.
Lindsay Hanley, one of the current supposed opponents of liberalism in Western society that we've seen talked about a lot about in the last year or so has been what are known as the traditional working classes. We've seen them kind of quoted in the American Rust Belt, in certain areas in Britain in terms of Brexit and so on. You were brought up in a what might be called a traditional white working class area. How did social liberalism play out in that context?
I think growing up, people had naturally liberal tendencies in terms of living and let living, just allowing other people to be, and yet sort of when asked maybe about how they felt about certain things would, or equally almost certainly, come out with things that would sound extremely illiberal socially. And so
my take some examples, Lindsay.
Well, for instance, when I was growing up, I knew children or teenagers who were clearly gay who were finding their way towards their sexuality and were kind of left to get on with it, essentially, and yet were doing so in an environment where it was kind of understood and expected anti-gay language would be used and that you wouldn't be called out for it. You know, there would be situations where people had mixed race children and mixed race grandchildren and, you know, were completely loved and accepted, and yet this took place again in a context where there was plenty of racist language used in an everyday context. You know, there was a sort of general sort of racist racial bogeyman in everyday conversation, and yet at the same time people were actually left to get on with their lives. And so it's that thing about the sort of the theory and practice of liberalism, when you actually get to the sort of granular detail of people's lives and sort of people living in communities, then the reality is kind of different to the rhetoric.
Now, you talked about some of the what we might describe as kind of socially conservative attitudes which were held in the place where you were brought up and other such places. Why do you think they're more important there than they have been amongst other sections of society?
I last year I wrote a book specifically about working class respectability, and one of the things I wanted to really sort of get to the bottom of and explore with some sort of degree of subtlety was just the fact that solidarity is an absolute necessity when you're in difficult circumstances, and so sort of solidarity in relationships and finding common ground and sort of having to insist on that common ground, or perceiving that you have to insist on that common ground just in order to sort of get by as a community. And I think this is, when I was growing up, I think this is something that I personally, you know, as a sort of raging teenager had a lot of problems with, because I subscribed to what would now be regarded, or what would now be termed, kind of metropolitan liberal values, you know, about sort of accepting difference, embracing difference, you know, believing in cultural diversity and finding it exciting. Whereas, you know, the necessity for solidarity often, you know, has to have bogeymen, you know, has to find others to sort of, you know, feel solidaristic, you know, against.
So in a way, what you're saying is that you almost wear this, if we call it social conservatism, this badge of kind of solidarity to show that you're fitting in.
Yes, Yes, and, you know, there is often not a lot of space to sort of interrogate that.
Oliver Letwin, you are a Conservative. You've been a leading thinker in the Conservative Party. Are Conservatives, modern Conservatives, say in Britain, conservative, or are they actually liberals? Are they the sons and daughters of the Duke of Wellington or the sons and daughters of Margaret Thatcher?
Well, the only answer to that is both. I mean, it's a coalition. What unites Conservatives in this country, and I think it is somewhat similar in the States, is a mistrust of the overweening power of the state and a scepticism about the ability of state mechanisms to solve all problems. What separates Conservatives and means that it's the Conservative Party is a coalition is that on the one side you have people who do all the things that we've just been talking about, celebrate diversity, believe in endless discussion and argument as the way to the truth, think that it's nice to have a society in which there are all sorts of different people doing all sorts of things, and believe that the rights of the individual encoded in the law are the foundation of civilization. And on the other side, you have a group of Conservatives who believe that things would be much better if there was much more of what was being described as solidarity and stress the nation and its history and so on. So there is a coalition going on.
Oliver, can we just examine a place where two liberal values come into conflict? Let's take the case of different religious beliefs that actually have unequal education for girls as one of their precepts. Where would you go with that?
Liberals actually care both about group rights and individual rights. And the case you're citing is one where group rights conflict with individual rights. And that's a real difficulty for those of us that are liberals, because I want to respect both the ability of parents to make choices about how their children are brought up and communities, religious communities, to make decisions about how their whole communities bring up their children. And on the other side, I want to respect the ability of the individual girl, for example, to get a proper education. And you just have to sort these out sort of case by case. There isn't a sort of rule book for liberals.
OK, Oliver, can I offer you an example of a subject that might create conflict between liberals and conservatives? And that's migration. I mean, one of the ways in which you hear this put is that the problem of migration, take out the economics of it, let's suppose there were no question of economics in it whatsoever, would simply be one of whether or not the solidarity that Lindsay was talking about can be maintained in a situation where there are people who are coming in who may not share those attitudes, may or may not share, or who you don't necessarily want to share those things with.
Yes. Well, I think, I mean, the liberal position, of course, there are many different liberals with many different positions, but broadly, the liberal position on the movement of peoples is that actually innovation and ideas and exuberance and all the things that make civilizations prosper come from people moving around the world. I think a conservative liberal certainly wants to see integration going on. And I think that the way that liberals can reconcile belief in movement of people with the need for a society to have some degree of integration is by arguing, for example, that everyone should speak a common language. You can't actually have the arguments liberals treasure if everybody's speaking in different languages in a Tower of Babel. So it wouldn't do to parody the liberal position as being just, you know, everybody goes everywhere and nobody talks to anybody. But on the other side, a liberal does certainly believe that the mixtures of people are a good thing, not a bad thing.
Lindsay Handley, what do you think?
Just wanted to agree with elements of what Oliver was saying, but also to point out that the solidarity that I was talking about before is not necessarily a chosen solidarity. It's a solidarity born out of harsh circumstances and you know, and sort of hard necessity, and therefore isn't automatically a good thing. So if you have a situation, you know, where you've got 50 or 60,000 people in a new environment that's quite geographically isolated in terms of economic and educational and transport opportunities, then that solidarity can lead to something entirely different. You know, it can lead to people, you know, turning inwards essentially and not being in a situation where they might be able to find out, you know, that those benefits of diversity that Oliver was talking about.
But can I put it to both of you, but to you mainly at this point, Oliver, that a lot of people feel that they don't get the benefits of this globalisation. In other words, they suffer the disbenefits of the breakup of their patterns of solidarity. There are people not like them, more and more of them around, and they're not always quite sure how that should go. So there's a degree of disorientation without the concomitant benefits which might kind of offset those, or the benefits aren't great enough, or they accrue to somebody else.
Well, I think there are two things at play here. One is a real felt experience of lots of people who've been struggling for many years, particularly obviously since the 2008 crash. And whether you look at what happened in Sunderland in the Brexit vote or what happened in the Rust Belt in the States, I think you're seeing the ricochet effects of people having a hard time for many years. And that's real, and it needs response. And the kind of response that's needed, I think, is things that make those people's lives better. But and then you can fall to a political argument about what is the best way and so on. But alongside that, actually, I think what's gone on is a whole heap of mythologizing and sheer fantasizing about the cause of this. It is not being caused, in most cases, by migration. I have constituents in West Dorset who haven't seen a migrant for years, who nevertheless believe that somehow or other there's a problem which has been caused by migrants. And that's because they've been told to think that by the Daily Mail.
Emin Fawcett, what do you think?
I think we have to remember that liberalism, in the sense we're talking about it, is about how to do politics. It's about how we organise very fluid, very energetic societies with lots of different views without having explosions, without degenerating into war or conflict.
One of the things which has characterised this end-of-year discussion about liberalism has been its identification, touched on very slightly there, with the metropolitan elite. Oliver, when people talk about the metropolitan elite and they talk about, in a way, opposition or disappointment, what do you hear?
My view is that actually these attitudes are that we're talking about are attitudes which people take up regardless of their particular circumstances. It's got nothing to do with whether you're metropolitan, whether you're elite. It's got to do with whether you think in the end that a society which fizzes with excitement because people are freed and the energies of people are freed and there are all sorts of different people thinking all sorts of different things and doing different things and exchanging with one another and debating with one another is a good thing, or whether that vision appalls and dizzies you and you want a society in which it's all very orderly and everyone goes to the same church or synagogue or mosque or whatever it is and they all do the same things every day of the week and they all think the same things and they all know what they ought to think because there's some authority that tells them, which is a vision that I don't like.
Can I invite you to do the really liberal thing, which is to put the most positive gloss you can on the thing that you have just created a negative for? Because it strikes me that you could also have said about those things that they were people who had a very strong sense of community.
Yes.
They had a very strong sense of solidarity and obligation, yes, of one set of people to another. That they were likely to have a strong sense of nationhood and patriotism, yes, which has always been very... actually, I've done it now, haven't I?
So yeah, I think you've given a very good characterization of the virtues of a certain kind of certain kinds, because there are many, of social conservatism. And there are real virtues, of course there are. However, actually, in the end, those sorts of societies fall under their own weight. And what the liberal is arguing is you can have those same virtues encouraged in a state which is vastly, in a society which is vastly more diverse and open. Now, that's an argument which is going to continue to rage.
Emin Fawcett, do you think liberalism is under threat? I mean, looking around the world, looking at the last year.
Well, I don't think we have to rethink liberal democracy's ideals. I mean, is there a better outlook? I don't think it's any accident that so many people across the world want to come and live in these countries. It's not an accident that liberal democracies tend to dominate the top of the UN league tables in human well-being. I don't think either the basic ground rules and institutions of liberal democracy are under threat from authoritarian or anti-parliamentary movements in the way that they came under threat in the 1920s and 30s. I don't think that. However, I do think that liberalism, liberal democracy, is in very difficult shape. And I think just very quickly, three things. You now have in Washington and here in Britain, governments without serious opposition. And that kind of imbalance is always unhealthy. Looking back in its period of great strength, liberal democracy since the post-war period was sometimes centre-right, sometimes centre-left, each correcting the other. But there was, you know, basic agreement about the ground rules and intense argument about ways and means. I think that kind of argument I see not present. Second, both in Washington and here, you have governments that are jeopardizing the rules of kind of multilateral open trade and cooperative agreement on which liberal democracy in the world thrived. You have Trump certainly talks a very unilateralist language. And finally, I think one of the big difficulties with liberal democracy is that, you know, we keep calling it something that it isn't. And I think it's terribly important to try and isolate what it is that liberal democracy is, that it's a good way of doing politics, and to look back over the last, you know, our lifetimes, if you will, you know, last, you know, since several decades, and see what was really good about it, and understand it better, and not mislabel it.
Oliver, what about you?
I think liberal democracy has certainly, you know, had some interesting times. Actually, I think the biggest challenge to it by far, much bigger than the ones which have been described, is what happened in 2008 and its continuing ricochet effects. I think actually we had the biggest shock to the capitalist system that it's experienced since 1929, and it's no surprise that the after effects of that are quite considerable. So, I mean, I think we have to take seriously the point that you can't sustain a liberal democracy unless the whole population feels that it's got a stake in it and is getting something from it and is doing reasonably. And at the moment, we have real problems for large numbers of people that do need attention, as I was saying earlier. But if you look at China, just to end with that, I mean, I think I'm hugely optimistic. They've established free market capitalism in a communist state gradually, inevitably, probably very slowly, and maybe sensibly very slowly, because it took us hundreds of years to do this too. They will work through the implications of the free market they've created, and eventually there will be some kind of open democracy. And, you know, I'm hugely optimistic that actually 2.6 billion people in India and China are likely to be dominating our world 30, 40 years from now, and I think they will probably at that time both be relatively stable democracies.
Edmund Fawcett, what does liberalism have to do to optimise the outcome for itself?
I think I completely agree. 2008, terrible crisis. It's not clear to me that neoliberalism, as it were, you know, markets solve everything, is really the best policy. I think liberalism can offer a way forward by you know, being very, very clear about what it is it stands for, being inclusive, and if liberals from the centre all the way through to, you know, the liberal left could in some way join together and form a coherent opposition, I think I'm quite optimistic.
Lindsay Hanley.
I'm choosing to be that optimistic, I think, because the alternative is too grim to is too grim to imagine, really. But I do think that's the case, and I think demography is against those nativist movements ultimately. And I don't think you can discount, you know, as with China, you know, the sheer numbers of people entering higher education, you know, the massification of higher education, and also the mass entrance of women into A, into higher education, and B, into the workplace. You can't look at those things without imagining that they will at some point affect, and hopefully positively affect, politics in the near to medium term future.
Lindsay Handy, thank you very much for ending this on the what I kind of regard as the demographic death argument, which is that opponents to liberalism will die out in sufficient numbers to allow it to be triumphant. Thank you all for joining me in the briefing room. That's thanks to my guests, Lindsay Hanley, Edmund Fawcett and Sir Oliver Letwin. And a Merry Christmas to you, the listeners, and we'll see you in the new year. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. My producer for this episode was Hannah Sander. The sound engineer was Nigel Appleton. Research was by Kirstine Knight. We're always grateful to hear what people think of The Briefing Room. If you'd like to let us know your views, there's an easy way to do it. Just leave a rating, or even better, a review, on iTunes or your podcast provider. Thanks for listening.
Innovation bringt die Welt seit jeher voran, doch sie birgt auch Risiken. In einer Welt, in der sich Technologie und künstliche Intelligenz weiterentwickeln, stellt sich AXA XL den Risiken. Als einer der führenden globalen Versicherer setzen wir ständig neue Maßstäbe, um Ihre Daten und Netzwerke vor Cyberrisiken zu schützen.
AXA XL. Risiken eingehen für eine Zukunft voller Möglichkeiten. Diese Anzeige stellt weder ein Angebot oder eine Aufforderung dar, noch ist sie eine Beschreibung von Produkten oder Dienstleistungen von AXA XL.
Innovation bringt die Welt seit jeher voran, doch sie birgt auch Risiken. In einer Zeit, in der die Welt neue Energielösungen benötigt, stellt sich AXA XL den Risiken. Als einer der führenden globalen Versicherer setzen wir ständig neue Maßstäbe, um die Energiewende zu beschleunigen.
AXA XL. Risiken eingehen für eine Zukunft voller Möglichkeiten. Diese Anzeige stellt weder ein Angebot oder eine Aufforderung dar, noch ist sie eine Beschreibung von Produkten oder Dienstleistungen von AXA XL.